All right, welcome to episode 5 of the Space Game Junkie Podcast. Thank you, everyone, for joining me. I'm, by the way, if I sound different, I'm on a brand new microphone, and it's very pretty, and I really like it. Joining me always is Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hey. Howdy, howdy.
And we have some guests this week. Why don't you all introduce yourselves, folks?
All right. My name is Tyler Yeo. I'm the CEO and creative director of Broken Crown Games.
My name is Asa Gillette. I'm the producer of our first game.
I'm Christopher Chang. I am the lead programmer of Broken Crown Games.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us, guys. We really appreciate you taking the time. Tyler, we talked a little bit a while back, but it was just you and me. So it's nice to get a little kind of group thing going, more voices to bounce off than just yours and mine. So let's start with the format, because we're trying to stick to one because we kind of lost it recently in the last episode or two. But I don't really have any news to talk about because I didn't really have time to do much news. So I'm sorry, folks. I mean, the big news is what we'll be talking about later with a Kickstarter. So that's, I guess, news. But let's talk about what we're playing. Broken Crown, folks. What are you guys playing over there?
But we've been trying to catch up on certain games these past like few weeks leading up to Con. So we're trying to like get all like the latest like 2012, 2013 games released done. Like I finished up Halo 4 like recently. So I was like, oh, like, okay, I'm done with that. And then just in time for like Microsoft to start announcing like the follow-ups.
I honestly haven't had any time lately to play very many video games, but the only two I've really forced myself to make time for are actually two games that still aren't complete or out yet, but I kickstarted both Banner Saga and Castle Story. So I've been trying to do my best to play their alphas and betas a while and test them out a little bit.
Oh, cool. I haven't seen Castle Story, but I did play a little bit of Banner Saga, and I'm really digging what they're doing there.
Yeah, I love both. And actually, I completely agree. Banner Saga, I really love what they're trying to do there. So
that game seems like it would be right at home on a tablet as well. I'm kind of surprised that they didn't take that route.
Yeah, I'm interested to see where they take that multiplayer aspect.
Yeah, because just what they've got so far, that's that, you know, like free alpha that they've released, they could have sold that on iOS for like $10 a game all day.
Yeah. But I mean, one reason I couldn't resist Banner Saga was just the whole back lore, and it just seems like a great RPG element that they've gotten that. So even though it's turn based, it should be pretty interesting. So.
So speaking of RPGs, because your game is going to be an RPG?
Yep.
Of sorts, or okay.
Actually, after we just got done from MegaCon, we were talking over our game a little bit, and Chris actually pointed out a pretty good point. One of my main inspirations when I first started bringing on the developing team was definitely trying to get them to look at the game like I was, and one of the first things I was telling them was think Mass Effect-ish. And Chris pointed out a lot of the inspiration that I've been pointing towards has always been basically BioWare titles.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they've definitely got like the storytelling element in there, and it's sometimes their choose the good path, choose the bad path is a little bit like the bad path seems like overly so, yeah. You know, but it's kind of like at least they give you some choice in there.
Yeah.
I'm a big proponent of the Mass Effect games. I think, and I've been trying to convince Brian, who has not played any Mass Effect games.
Brian, we're going to have to dog on you there.
That's it, Brian. I'm calling you out.
God damn it.
Mass Effect 2, with all the DLC on it, especially, well, the DLC that gives you the additional characters. I don't care about the rest of the stuff, but the characters, because that's what matters in that game.
Yeah.
And it's the fact that you and I could play that game, come away with whole completely developed stories about what happened, and tell them to each other. And it's like we played two totally separate games, except for some places of commonality where they have to come back to a central point. But like the relationships with the characters and stuff, and that actually kind of sticks with me. Like other games, I forget the name of the guy who sold me the gun and the, you know, whatever. But this is just like, I remember everything that went on like years later.
And actually you made two awesome points there that, thrown back towards what we're trying to do with our game. First one was, just the good and bad thing. When I was first selling this game to my developing team and trying to convince them to come on for free, I mean, that's a hard sell right there. So one of the things I was telling them is, look, I'm trying to do something completely different. And although, yeah, I'm really inspired by those BioWare games where it's always a good and evil path, since we're doing a hard science fiction where everything's supposed to be realistic, I really didn't feel there in real life there isn't the perfectly good path and perfectly evil path. So even though we are kind of taking that same inspiration from BioWare there, we kind of started straying away from the good and evil. It's kind of a shades of gray for either side where you might agree with one thing that side does, but disagree with another thing. You might bond with one character on one side, but not bond with another character on that same exact side. So there's really just shades of gray for each side that we're trying to build in these games.
Hmm. Well, given a choice, right? Like if you're in a situation where it's like, do I shoot the guy on the left or the guy on the right, you know? And I have to make a decision that's just as easy as that. And they're like both people that I would want rid of. So depending on what you do in a situation like that would shape, you know, the outcome for, you know, you're going to miss things that other person might have done in the story,
yeah,
kind of deal. But if it's a gray choice, you know, where it's like, to kind of replicate somewhat of a life decision, but on a bigger scale, like I want to do the right thing. There's two possibilities. Either one could turn out to be the right thing. You know, do I take the left path or the right path, not knowing that one is a clean choice of, okay, I'm going to do the bad thing.
Yeah.
Right. So,
and that's kind of how we want it to be. We want everything to be a decision, not just like, kind of like in, hate to keep going back to it, but not like in the BioWare games where you always, depending on which way you want to go, you always click the top dialogue, or you always click the bottom dialogue, always knowing it leads to mm-hmm. one of those two. Ours is more, you have to really think about what you're saying. Because it will affect differently each and every time. And,
right. And it's a thing too.
Go ahead.
Well, a thing too in that is that the replayability of the game, if it's not a black and white decision of, oh, I'm always going to take the right path or always take the left path. If I actually do the thing that actually seems right to me to be the right thing, even given multiple versions of that, that's going to drive replayability with me where I'm going to want to come back through the game and say, well, what if I took the other correct action?
Yeah. And that's actually, you're bringing up all the awesome points here. That's actually one thing I really wanted to focus on from day one was I pretty much laid out a few things. One was, again, trying to go for the realism with the science behind the sci-fi, and then kind of doing a science outreach with the game. Two was trying to provide deep immersion where players really bonded with characters, which hits on what you said earlier, where in Mass Effect you really bond to certain characters and you remember them. That's kind of important because if you remember everything about the game and you stay attached to it, it helps, again, with that science outreach portion. They're always going to remember the game and in return probably remember a little bit of the science. And then number three is, so you've got the immersion, you've got the science realism, and then the third one you're really looking for is that replayability. We're an indie team. We can't build a 20-hour game, so we want it to be a game where it's a great story, but you can play through it all kinds of different ways. That way, even though we don't have the ability to make lots and lots and lots of little levels or zones, you can play through those levels and zones multiple times and have a different experience each and every time.
Okay. What's the presentation of the game? Like, what sort of format? Are you, is it going to be kind of like a Scum Engine thing where you point at something on the screen and your character goes over and interacts with it? Or are you first person or what?
So the game is actually a third person over the shoulder view. You'll be playing through as a full action adventure. So you're going to have full control over your character. It's not going to be a point and click or anything like that. With that, you'll be able to interact with your environments. Move through the actual different scenarios and levels that we have put forth and interact with different characters and objects to kind of immerse yourself in the levels.
Guys, I just realized we haven't even mentioned the name of the game. What? Tell us what it's called.
I thought names were overrated, but So the name of the game is actually Broken Crown Escaping Titan.
And the purpose of the game, if I remember correctly, is to pretty much build a ship and a crew and get the heck off Titan.
Yep.
Yeah, Titan's a pretty nice place. Why would anyone want to leave?
Well, I mean, actually, I mean, in this whole Firefly-esque thing where there's all these worlds that are terraforming around you, yeah, obviously Titan's pretty hostile, but it is the new capital, so you would think it's a kind of a cushy place in the solar system. But, I mean, one thing that we like to tell people about the storyline is when it became capital of the solar system, they got to remember that there was this huge influx of power and money. And when that influx of power and money came in, it kind of broke the economy of the city. So when that happened, you basically got two governments forming around, basically one government saying, hey, I'm going to support the little guys and the workers of the environment. And then another government around the elitists that are kind of high up and have all the money. And so now
does that sounds so familiar. That sounds really familiar.
Yeah. And that's kind of, part of where the inspiration comes, except it's maybe a little bit more violent than the Democrats and Republicans. But
So if you can bring me, because I'm coming into this kind of cold, like I glanced over the website, I looked at the Kickstarter post and I kind of gleaned some stuff from that, but I'm still trying to sort it out in my head. So there was this very bad thing that happened to Earth where the sun had a coronal flare that kind of reached out, burnt Earth up. And then there were some other colonies that had just started, right? It was like, was it like a space colony? And then there was some people on Mars and like some people on the moon, and that was about it? Or were we established on other planets?
Nope.
Throughout the system?
We weren't quite established yet. So basically what starts out happening is, like you said, there's a coronal flare, hits Earth, and blows a little bit. We actually worked with our scientists on this one. We brought in a special astrophysicist just to help us out with the coronal loop aspect. But basically a solar flare could hit Earth, mess up the magnetic field, and let a little bit of the atmosphere blow away. And as a result, gamma radiation can start coming in more, and it would slowly kill off all of life on Earth. And on top of that, obviously, when the solar flare hits, all the electronics go. And as a result, pretty much Earth is slowly dying. Luckily, though, we do have a small colony of scientists out on Mars, kind of like we currently have on the International Space Station. So they're not really set up for long-term stays. They're just there maybe 6 months to a year, and they're relying on supplies from Earth. And so now these guys are kind of cut off from their life source, and they have to find a way to make a go of things on Mars. And so they manage to do so, and they end up surviving and thriving eventually, and they terraform and colonize all of Mars. And then they realize the ignorance of trying to be a one-planet species, so they immediately start their own space age and start what's called the Terra Boom era. And during that period, they start spreading out across the solar system.
Okay, so from the time of the coronal event, first off, so it wasn't like an instant death to Earth. We had time to establish a colony and evacuate as many people off as we could then? Or no, was it like a real quick timetable of Earth's just gone one day?
No, Earth's – it's pretty much those two are now cut off from one another because there is no space shuttle or anything on Mars where they can start transporting people. Like they can't fly back to Earth and shuttle people back to Mars because they don't have the technology on Mars at that time. And Earth, they don't have any technology anymore because the solar flare pretty much destroys it all. It fries all the motherboards and circuit boards. So Earth is pretty much stranded on Earth, and they're just left there to pretty much die over a long period of time.
So how many people were on Mars at the time? Like a couple hundred? Yep, or
pretty much. It's just a small space laboratory.
So at that point, and I think that would be an interesting premise there because – Where your game takes place is how long after this?
So actually, and we want to try to save a lot for later in the future, but we do actually already have a prequel for Escaping Titan set up and a sequel. And the prequel is actually called Surviving Mars. It's actually based on that time period where you're trying to repopulate Mars.
Oh, okay. Because I think That would be very interesting. Like if somebody wanted to just go for a science fiction novel, I don't think a movie could quite cover it, right? Because a movie would give you like a 2-hour slice of life or something. But to have a novel where you could talk about what happened in that. And in looking at the source material that you guys were putting together, which you said in the Kickstarter, it was available on the forums, but your forums were kind of brokish the other day when I went.
Yeah.
But are those actual like PDF documents, or did you mean like by perusing the forums, you'll get the content that will be in the source book?
So the source book is actually a 5-volume source book. The first 4 volumes are the Science Behind the Sci-Fi volumes written by the PhDs that are consulting on the project. And those 4 volumes, pretty much everything you're going to find in the source book is available on our forums for free. We really don't want to make the science hard to access or pay to access. We want that to be available for free. Anyone that wants to learn is able to. And so when our forums are actually working, which they are now, that was actually an issue with PHBB that they've since resolved. But
okay, because in our show notes, I want a hot link like right to the posts where these things are.
Yep.
So, because I was thinking, like, and especially you guys are going around and you're doing the cons, which is like pen and paper role playing and stuff at these, right? And,
so at MegaCon, that was kind of a mix of your cosplayers and your comic fans and stuff like that. So there wasn't a huge gaming audience. I like to kind of explain our tour that we're covering the spectrum of what our game covers. Our game is obviously very narrative based, and that's more what MegaCon's about. They're more about the narratives and the stories. And then once you move to PAX East, it's a bit of a mix between gamers and the cosplayer and comic book narrative people. And then once you shift from that, then it's GDC, which is 100% gaming. So now we've hit our story people, we've hit our gaming people. And then our final conference is actually the National Space Symposium, which is the space people or the science people. So we hit all 3 aspects, the narrative-based people, the gaming people, and the space people. So
okay, because it's a thing where I look at in a situation like that where let's say there's like 200 or 300 people that are left alive, right? Yep. And it's the scientists and that are on Mars. And at that point, you realize, okay, we can never go home and we have to establish a stable – you know, there's no supplies coming, so we have to figure out how do we eat, how do we dispose of waste, how do we do, you know, take care of the human element. And then it's a thing, too, of like, well, we have to build population, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like these few hundred people, it's their burden now to repopulate humanity.
Yeah.
And try to spread to multiple planets so that no single planet event can wipe them out. So I think that there would be some really, really interesting socio-political things that would surround that kind of weight dropping on such a small group of people.
Yeah, I mean, and that comment right there, as well as what you were saying about it'd be interesting to see a novel based around this, does kind of lead to that 5th volume of the source book that we're selling right now. Actually, and we haven't quite released this, so I'll give you guys a little bit of an exclusive here. It'll actually be up on Kickstarter soon. And so that 5th volume, the very first 2 source books, or sorry, short stories of volume 5, and possibly even the 3rd short story of volume 5 will all be based around the Broken Crown event, like when the solar flare is hitting, and the dynamic that occurs on Mars after that happens. And these are just short stories, but I would love if I ever got the funding and time to write a full novel about all this and the entire trilogy. So
that's another that's another Kickstarter.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's a thing too of like whenever you're building all this source material and figuring out the story in that, you've done about 3/4 of the legwork of publishing it as a pen and paper RPG.
Yeah.
Once you've put your source book together. Yeah. So I would think that that's a natural move to also publish some sort of pen and paper thing. And even if, you know, that's not a product that you would sell, maybe to, you know, cause like whenever they did Fallout, they also put like the RPG rules version of it off to the side. Right. So I think that that's something, if you guys are going to the effort in there, then you've got 2 products here.
Yeah. I would love to start doing stuff like that. So it's right now, it's just a matter of getting the time.
Yeah. Do you have like an RPG sort of system that's underneath? or is it just driven by, you know, like, is it an event triggered thing, or is there actually like dice rolling against traditional role playing game type skills and stats underneath?
Are you talking about the source book or what exactly?
No, I'm talking about you, the game that you're actually trying to produce. Is it going to be more of like a 3D action adventure kind of thing with some heavy conversation stuff? Or is there actually like some dice mechanic, like traditional pen and paper things?
It's a little bit of like a factor of chance involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's our combat is heavily based on traditional RPG aspects, but there is active combat, but some of the active combat to do like skills or whatnot involve like an aspect of chance of it actually failing, or if you like basically roll like a bad number, you don't do such a high combat thing.
So actually, I mean, like I said, a lot of this, the game itself is still in development. So we're kind of tight-lipped about the game itself rather than the lore, which is what we've focused a lot of our pre-production time over the last year and a half on, as well as the base level coding. But so what we're looking at right now, so I can't guarantee it until we're a little bit further into development, but we're looking to do a 2 difficulty game, and that's it, just 2 different difficulties. And the main difference between the 2 difficulties is difficulty 1, which we're just calling novice, is kind of more of a World of Warcraft-esque game, where you have your abilities, you press a button, and just like you said, traditional RPG style, it's kind of a back-end code roll where you're just rolling the dice and it determines if you hit, miss, crit, that type of thing. It's just pure chance. However, if you move to the next difficulty, which is we're just calling it experienced for right now, it's more based on the player, how the game mechanics will work. And it's all pretty much a quick time event thing where, depending on what type of combat you do, you have a different type of quick time event. And then on top of that, the harder your ability hits and the higher level abilities you're using, the more difficult that quick time event will be.
Mm. Well, I have a question. You were talking about the lore, which I think is great. Now, I'm wondering, are you writing this by yourself, or do you have someone else helping you write the lore? I'm just curious. And how much of that will be in the game itself? Like, one thing I just love to do sometimes is when I'm running around like Skyrim, I'll just pick up a book and read it because it's just fascinating. Will there be anything like that in Escaping Titan?
So right now, most of the reading content where you would just walk up to an item and read it is actually Easter eggs, where we're just throwing random stuff in there that I've come up over the last 2 years. I'd be like, man, that'd be funny if someone would come across us and read it. And so I'd write a little note to myself to throw it in there. However, most of the actual lore that I'm writing, and yes, I'm actually writing it all by myself. And obviously the 4 PhDs are consulting with me to make sure everything I write is scientifically accurate or plausible. But basically most of the lore that you're going to find in the source book is not what you're going to find in the video game. It's completely different content, but all the stuff in the source book is actually lead up content. I like to kind of explain it like a comic book. You can watch the Spider-Man movie without ever reading the comics and enjoy it by itself. And then same thing with the comics. You can read the comic books without ever watching the movie and still enjoy the comic books.
Ah.
And so each of these short stories are kind of like one episode of a comic. And then you put all the comic books together and then watch the movie. Now you understand everything. So when you go to play the game, if you've read the source book and read all the little short stories, you have all the buildup. And so maybe you'll get a quest to, hey, take this note to my parents. And in the game, you're kind of like, if you've never read the source book, you'll kind of be like, okay, why don't you take it to your parents yourself? But if you've read the source book, now you'll understand all the NPCs. And for instance, that character, you'll understand her dynamic with her family and her parents and what's happened in the past that would cause her to ask you to take a note and all that kind of stuff. And to try to throw all that content into the game would just slow the game down too much and kind of ruin your experience while playing. But if we can put it in a source book, it kind of brings everything together and allows you to experience the world and just immerse yourself in it.
So yes, I think there is going to be a little bit of references to things in the game.
That's cool. Are you guys planning further source books for the prequel and the sequel as well? Kind of follow-ups?
Yep, I'd love to do that. Right now, with the source book, it's pretty much all set in stone, like what we're going to be writing. The scientists are well on their way with that content as well. So at this point, it's pretty much just our main focus for the next 2 years is development of the game and getting that done and involving the fans as much as possible, which is actually where all the funds from our Kickstarter are going, is to find ways to keep the fans involved over the next 2 years.
Speaking of, congratulations. I said this earlier before we started recording, but you've already reached your very, very modest goal.
Yeah. Thank you.
And this is probably, I'll be honest, I think this is the smallest Kickstarter goal I have ever seen.
Well, I mean, really, we don't feel the fans need to pay us money to do what we love doing. So,
right.
So it's kind of a Kickstarter for promotional reasons then.
Yeah. I mean, we've already got, the PhDs. They've like gratefully agreed to volunteer their time to write their volumes. I absolutely love writing the sci-fi side. So the fifth volume's just me as well. So really we don't need to pay anyone a salary to get the source book out. And since we're doing the bottom levels as ebooks, pretty much we don't need too much capital to really get this stuff out to the fans. Right. So what we decided is all the money that we raised from this Kickstarter just should go back to the fans. So we're finding ways to involve them in development. For instance, right now during our Insomnia tour at MegaCon, we just got done and we're going to PAX East here in a couple days. But I mean, what we did there is we're actually letting fans record animations that have a chance of going to into the game. So fans can actually get their name in the credits. And then on top of that, actually vote on which animations do make it into the game.
And the Kickstarter is helping to fund all that.
Exactly. So, I mean, like you said, our goal was fairly humble, but right now,
and
one of the things.
And I'm not saying that like it's a bad thing. It's fantastic. I'm just fascinated.
Yeah.
I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah, we just want fans to see that we're out there, and we want to find ways to really get them more content without continuing to break our bank. So basically, yeah, we want to make content easier to see, which is what that 250 is going to go towards. We're now going to be able to get rid of the AdWords on our site. And then now we've just released our future stretch goals, which are all other future ways to get fans content and get them involved, such as podcasts in the future and possibly YouTube channels. So I guess we'll see.
Oh, what's a fan stretch goal? Is that like when you reach 25 fans, when you reach 50 backers, that sort of thing? Oh, okay. Yep.
So basically,
it's an interesting idea. I've actually never seen that before in a Kickstarter. It's usually always about the money, never about the amount of backers.
Yeah. I actually am kind of surprised by that as well. I've never seen it, but, I mean, kind of like Jim was saying, the whole point is to kind of draw attention to ourselves and get some fans. So we decided that should be one of our goals, not just the financial side. But even if we have 100 fans donate at $1, that's just as important to us as having 10 donate at $10. So we decided that should be a stretch goal there, just doing it based on backers.
Now, I have to say that is pretty awesome because I think there's something about some Kickstarter fatigue, and there's been news lately about Kickstarter projects like losing money and not being able to finish. So I think this kind of fan/backer stretch goal really shows that it's not just about the money, which I think people might want to see more of this. I think people need to see this.
Yeah. And to go on that, honestly, whether or not we make tons and tons of money off of this or not, we're all kind of committed to finishing the project. Right. So whether or not we get $1 million on our Kickstarter, it doesn't really matter to us. As long as we have some fans out there that are really interested in what we're doing, and whether it be one fan, whether it be a million fans, we want to make sure that we're getting something out there that kind of changes how people are looking at things. And also gives them something to learn about.
Well, it's kind of fascinating because you're putting a value on not just what the fan is donating, but also on the fan itself, him or herself.
Honestly, I don't think we can put a price on how much a fan means to.
Well, not a price, a value. You're showing that a fan has value besides what they just donate, which is awesome. And it's a fantastic idea because I think people are going to need to see that because, again, there's some kind of – there's fatigue out there. People are getting tired of Kickstarters failing. So this is – I have to just say this is an excellent idea.
Thank you.
Well, I'm just glad that there's a game coming down the pike that's not about, you know, how quick I can squeeze the trigger to resolve political differences. You know, so who are the players here? Because it's been a while since the whole Earth event, and then Mars build up. They've spread out to different moons and planets, and Titan is the new capital, right? So I'm curious about like who are the players there. And there is going to be an action element to the game. So who am I shooting and why? and is it important? Like if there's a place in the story where I pull a gun out and I actually use it, is that something that is very atypical in the story? Like that's punctuation on a very serious event, like a firefight went down and characters that were known people actually died, or is it like we shoot a bunch of goons kind of thing every now and then?
Jim, it never matters why you shoot someone. It's just because they're there. They're in front of you. They make a pretty target. You just put a bullet in them or a laser. That's all that matters.
They destroyed the Death Star, and now we're out.
Have you seen that short about the Death Star was an inside job?
Yeah. Oh, I have not. What is this? I've been so out of the
loop. I'll link it to you.
Okay.
It's excellent. It's like a 911 conspiracy video, but done about the Death Star.
Oh, no.
And how everybody involved in that was related, you know?
Oh, no.
So, but anyway, right. Yeah, it was great. They used the music cues and everything. So, but anyway, what's the relationships going on between the different human factions, and why do they all think that they're doing the right thing but disagree?
So the two major factions are the Underground and the Capitol Guard. So kind of like I said, when Titan was named the Capitol, there was a huge influx of power and money. And so when that happened, all these higher-ups started moving into kind of like you were alluding to earlier, was Titan's not exactly a friendly environment. It's a very hostile planet. So everyone lives inside of a biodome. And so when all these people started moving in, like all these rich, money-hungry people started moving into this biodome, it really caused an overpopulation issue inside of it. And so with nowhere to go and no money to kind of buy out these rich people that are moving in, the working class kind of got forced outside of the biodome, living inside these harsh conditions. And so that caused what's called the outskirts, which is another zone in the game, where basically these people live in a very hostile section that's not covered by a dome. And at any given time, a huge Titan jet storm could come by and basically kill off the people that are outside. So it's just a very harsh environment to live outside of the dome. And that's where the working class now lives. And so obviously with the money coming in and the capital, or the Titan being named Capital, the government basically took over the city, and that's where the Capitol Guard comes in. They're basically the government goons. But like I said, they're in there for a reason. They're trying to keep order in their new city capital. They're there to provide structure to an environment. But obviously the working class doesn't think so. They're kind of being ruled over by these people and told just to live out in these harsh conditions. And because of that, now when Titan was first terraformed, there was underground tunnels built into the surface of Titan that were first used when the dome was being constructed. And so people, before they started the outskirts, some of the poor people started living in these early tunnels that have kind of been quarantined off and said people aren't allowed to go down in them anymore. So people started just kind of like sneaking down into these underground tunnels and basically squatting there. And so that started what's called the Underground. Basically, a leader kind of formed from that and said, hey, we shouldn't be taking this. And so that kind of mentality has spread across the population, saying the working class shouldn't put up with being forced out either underground or out into the outskirts. So now you kind of have this rich government and this poor population kind of fighting one another. And for the most part, they're civil. They can ride a train together and be fine. But I was talking to somebody else and they said, well, one person starts something and the other one finishes it. And that's kind of, yeah, that's the mentality that's going on there.
So basically you've got a sort of an oligarchy situation set up where there's absolute corruption in the government, and the middle class, the workers have been forced out and basically minimalized, even though without them, the entire structure would cave in anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, so, and it's not even necessarily that they're a corrupt government. They just they have their own objectives that are reasonable, at least within their means. Mm-hmm. They understand what they're trying to do. It just,
but they operate in a different world,
exactly,
than the laboring people. So of course they can afford the best. So they'll take the property, yep, basically.
Exactly.
So. So you end up basically with I don't know if you've studied any Roman history, but they had the Roman families that would have power and influence in the government, and then the people who were basically the civilians, not really peasants because it wasn't a feudal society, but call it that. But the peasantry would ally themselves with a house, which would be almost like a corporation. Right. So it's like, well, I work for IBM or I work for Xerox. Well, it's actually I work for Cicero. Right. And then I'm his gang of people, kind of thing. Do you guys have any sort of that thing going, or is there just a complete separation and opposition between the haves and the have nots?
Well, first off, I did actually study Roman history. I have 4 years of Latin under my belt. My Latin teacher would probably scold me if I didn't say something. So.
Yeah,
but no, it's not quite that bad of a dynamic yet. It's like I said, there's still, it's more, I like to still look at it more like Republicans and Democrats. Both of them are fighting for structure and order, but they're fighting for different classes, more or less. And so the underground isn't complete hatred of the structure or anything. They just feel the classes should be balanced a little bit more, kind of. Mm-hmm. Going more towards communism or something.
Yeah. Well, do they feel like a lack of social mobility? Like you can't really work hard enough and get back in the dome?
Yeah, exactly. And the other class is basically saying, well, we earned our spots here and we shouldn't be persecuted just because we earned our way ahead. So it's kind of, like I said, both governments have reasonable demands, but they don't really want to see the other side. So.
Mm. So what causes a shooting war to break out? Or is this just a small contained event?
Nope. It's pretty much the entire capital city is kind of this volatile atmosphere. And for the most part, like I said, they can be civil. But just like I said, you might not agree with all the views of both governments. You also might not like one person in either side, but like other people on each side. So, for instance, if you're with the Capitol Guard, you may meet a guard that's the coolest guard you could ever find, but then you meet the next guy and he's just a jerk and kind of shoving you around. So it's just personalities, just like human beings are human beings. They're going to vary greatly. So
so the antagonists, is it the character that the player plays? Is he one of the outsider people?
Yeah, he actually, like we're looking to possibly do a second playable. It's just a matter of how much money we can get. But that second playable, she actually grew up on planet. And so she grew up on Titan and understands this whole dynamic. Meanwhile, the first playable, Mapofu, he grew up off world and was kind of recruited onto the world as a doctor. So he's new to this whole fighting scenario and trying to, now when he realized what he walked into, he's ready to get off the planet. So.
Oh, okay.
It kind of reminds me, like, of the Firefly universe, like you said earlier, but on one planet. You have the central planets, you have the core, and then you have the independents.
That's a pretty good example, yep.
But a lot closer together, which would lead to a lot of problems in that universe, as it sounds like it does here.
Yeah, so the PhDs that you guys have working on this, because you're really critical on the science and, you know, how things would work in that time period and that. Do you have a sociologist
perhaps
that's contributing to this? Because the interaction between different groups of people, especially whenever they realize like, oh gosh, we're the last humans alive and we have to get along. kind of thing. You know, it's now that humans, you know, you're a few years down the road, humanity's got a little breathing room where they can afford to have some conflict. But I would think that they would be like on the transition phase from being survival mode humans to now we can get back to being douchey to each other.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much where they're at. No, we don't have a sociologist, but that's a great point, and I'd love to use this podcast as a way to basically make a shout out that we would love one. So what we do on the forums is we have the four PhDs that are consulting continually, but each month we actually bring a guest PhD in, and they consult on a different aspect that they're a professional in. And so bringing a sociologist in for a month to comment on that would be awesome.
Yeah, because you have a strange situation that comes up in some movies, right? Like we were joking about Morgan Freeman before, but like a movie like Deep Impact, right, where you can only save so many humans, right? Something catastrophic is about to happen. You've got enough warning to get 200 people on a spaceship and send them somewhere, right? And how do you handle that? Who do you pick and why? Well, in a situation where these people are already on Mars, and they were chosen because they're good scientists to be on a Mars mission, but not necessarily because they're the best people to rebuild humanity.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like there would be a whole dynamic about that and what skills are lost, right?
Right.
And because these are science people. These aren't manufacturing people or that whole thing. So there's like a whole bunch of human knowledge that just wouldn't be with them. You know, it's not like they took the internet with them.
Right. So, and there's also going to be the fact that, you know, these 200 people or so are going to feel the extra burden of, hey, you know, we're all that's left. That along with the crippling emotional toll that, hey, my family, my friends, my basically everything that I was going to eventually return to is all gone as well. So where that actual emotional toll takes on them, there's been plenty of movies out there that have kind of glimpsed over it based on just one person dying. But picture billions of people dying and you're all that's left. You know, how does that actually shape your emotional state and your sanity is definitely going to play into obviously surviving Mars and right, going forward from there.
Yeah, because I would think that humanity, even living under a really nice biodome on Titan and that, but you were talking about like the harsh conditions and that, the things that can happen, right? And at least humans we've survived one catastrophic event. So I would think that we, on one hand, would feel capable of surviving another one because now we took the steps, right? But on the other hand, we would be acutely aware that it is quite possible to lose an entire population like that.
Yeah.
So that's a thing of like having all your eggs in one basket under this one biodome thing there. And I think that would be like some tension, you know, even amongst those people, because where do they go? You know, if the biodome breaks, or let's say the people that they're kind of repressing decide that they have some violent extremists that like to blow holes in the dome.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of little things that go into it. And talking about the Broken Crown event, that's something kind of like you're saying, it's something that would definitely take a toll. And one thing I have been kind of very persistent on in my writing is making sure it's something that everyone knows about. It's kind of like 9/11. It's something that culture will always teach and people are always going to remember, whether it be through story, a long time from now, people are always going to kind of remember stuff like that. And you can almost go back to people will argue like the Great Flood, stuff like that. Like it's always going to be passed down generation from generation. It might not be the exactly correct story, but you always hear about it in the future. And so that's something that I always try to remember when I'm writing the story for Escaping Titan is, people are still going to be talking from this about this event thousands of years from then. So it might not be the exact event the way you hear about it day one. Like when you're reading that first person story, short story that you'll see in the source book, you'll see a guy on Mars hearing his first person account saying, man, this just happened, and he'll be experiencing it for himself. And then later in that same source book, you're getting someone else's account of that Broken Crown event thousands of years later, and they're explaining it completely different, but it's the same exact event, but still remembering it at least.
So how much time passed between the Broken Crown event and the time frame of the game again?
I don't tell, and I kind of do that intentionally. I want fans to really imagine for themselves and really think for themselves.
So it's like quite some time. It's not like just a couple generations. And,
exactly. Okay. So really what I want to do is I want this game to make people critically think about the story for themselves and try to analyze it themselves and say, well, they moved this far out into the solar system and takes this much time, and they would have to rebuild the space program. And I really want people to critically analyze it for themselves and kind of determine that and make it up for themselves and enjoy the story their own way a little bit.
So yeah, that's cool.
Sorry. I had a question about the universe, if you can say. So you're escaping Titan. Where else can you go? Like, because you said Mars, you said Titan. Where are other people around you?
So, kind of like I said, the main character, he's actually an off-worlder, so he's not from Titan. He actually came from the next moon in on Saturn, which is Rhea. I hope I'm not getting this wrong.
We're not going to know.
My scientists will yell at me, though. So I think it's Rhea. But so basically, the next moon in is a little bit smaller than Titan, but it's still one of the larger moons of Saturn. And so what I'm doing on that one is that's actually an ice planet. And on that planet is actually a resort world. So basically, all these rich elitists on Titan, when that planet is on the sunny side of Saturn, they fly out to it and they live up the life on this resort planet and get away from the overcrowding on Titan. But as soon as that planet starts to go back into the shadow side of Titan or of Saturn, they fly back to Titan and live inside the dome. So
must be nice.
This guy lived on a resort world, but he wasn't a rich kid growing up. He was like, he grew up with a parents that worked and basically were curators of this resort world. And so they were there when it went down into the dark side of Saturn. So he came from a poor family, essentially, but he became a doctor. And then there's also the next moon out. It's basically about the size of a large asteroid. And that one is actually where another main NPC comes from. But since you already donated, I'll let you wait till the source book comes out to give you his story.
come on, man.
Hey, I've already given you enough exclusives.
So some other questions about your universe. When Earth was destroyed, it took all the animals and the plants with it. So the only animals and plants that humans would have is what they had on Mars.
Exactly.
Which probably wasn't cows and pigs and giraffes and stuff. So what do people eat?
That's actually a great question. And that's one of the very first things I was trying to think when I was writing all this. And that's actually the main reason we brought a paleobotanist onto our team. First questions I posed to him was, hey, if we were to start a Mars colony, what plants would we take with us? So he went over that question in his first Science Beyond the Sci-Fi post and kind of analyzed, okay, if we were going to take stuff out to Mars, this is what would last on a space shuttle given current space technology. And this would be the most likely because we could not only grow it easily, but it's lightweight and it could survive low gravity. We could eat the fruits, we could eat the roots, we could eat the stem. And so it was basically the most useful plants. And he basically went over some of those. And then my personal thought process was one of the only animals we would probably take out that way when trying to establish an early Mars colony would probably be something like a goat, where we could, when it's getting older, we could actually eat it for meat. So once every couple of years, you actually get meat in your diet. But for the most part, you're using it for milk, butter, basically the comfort foods that are missing in the NASA space program. And NASA actually goes over what they feed their astronauts and why, because they've found that if they don't feed astronauts comfort foods, they actually start to get depressed and stuff like that. So I think a goat would actually be one species that they'd probably send out there pretty early to try to get like sustainable comfort food on the planet. So that would be another thing.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I was thinking like they would probably have to genetically engineer like what would grow in Martian soil. Right. So we need to make something that's like some kind of funky alien cabbage that'll grow, you know, and it's got like all the nutritional needs of a human, but it's just boring as hell to eat. But that's the only thing we can grow.
Yep. Actually, all I do anymore is look up what new technologies and research is being done. And actually, China's space agency is currently working on genetically engineering a few species to grow in Martian soil.
Oh, cool. Then I saw their neighbors in Japan have figured out a process for actually eating human feces. They turn it into poo burgers.
Yep.
And yeah, which is kind of gross. But you know what, man? If you have 10,000 people living in a biodome, you got to put the poop somewhere.
Yep. And then on top of that, you might not even have to worry about what grows in the Martian soil because a group of kids in – I forget which African country, but it was – kids, like actual kids, like 12 years old, 13 years old, they read a few books in their local library about how to do hydroponics, and they actually mm-hmm. found a way to grow plants without any soil, like plants that are naturally only grow in heavy soil environments. They found ways to use hydroponics to allow them continue to grow. So,
I mean, yeah, because I think just the sustainable food culture, right? No matter what it might be, it's going to be radically different from Earth.
Yep.
And it's going to have to be a sustainable, fully recyclable thing. So I think the palate is going to have to adapt a lot, yep. you know, to that situation.
My favorite double quarter pounders.
No soup for you.
Like I said, can have your double quarter pounder every like 2 years or so.
Wow. That'll be the best double quarter pounder ever.
But no, I completely agree. Actually, Jamie, our paleobotanist, that's one of the very first things he said in his first Science Beyond the Sci-Fi post. He said, if we're going to move out to space, our palates are going to have to change. So I think you'd really enjoy some of his posts.
Well, I would think that would kind of kill obesity, wouldn't it, if we can't eat all this fatty food, if it's not accessible all over the place.
I don't know. Well, see Wally?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole new realm of different physical problems that people would have, right? In the switch over to the nutritional stuff, because people can't get the nutrition right? Because they look and they say, well, we see these nutrients and these vitamins that are in here and this, so we can make some artificial thing that's got all those things and people will be fine. But it turns out, no, they're not. You know, there's something actually about the natural plants and animals that we consume that whenever we try to make artificial substitutes for that generally ends up with very undesirable side effects, you know, like obesity or cancer or, you know, whatever like that. So that's going to be a pretty testy thing. And there will definitely be new diseases and new deficiencies of, you know, people. And what's the gravity like on Titan? Right. Yep. So you're going to have like bone loss and things, all kinds of things that we don't even have to think about now in medicine.
And again, that's something else getting into the what would it be like with the gravity on Titan versus other planets and stuff like that. Now, I think you'd probably love Jacob's entries. He's actually our astrobiologist. He's going to be covering that here soon in a little bit.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I would like to hear specifically about the physiology effects that it's going to have on people being long-term, you know, if they're thousands of years occupying a moon, because they're going to have, like, weird gravity things, like the planet's going to pull them. It's going to be almost like gravity tides, right, being on a moon. Are we facing the planet this day or are we not? You know, it's like I weigh more certain hours of the day because we're planet side. So... yeah, there's a lot to do there.
Yeah,
And that's why I'm saying, like, you guys, if you're collecting all this information, for God's sake, publish it as a hardbound RPG game, and tour the conventions again, because you'll have an audience for that. You know, the hard sci-fi people instead of the Star Wars, you know, laser swords, pew pew.
I would totally, seriously, if you guys did a pen and paper RPG, I would kick that too. No question. Because I love that stuff.
Actually, going into the, kind of like you said, there's definitely going to be an audience for it. That's why we want to do it. We know there are people that love hard sci-fi and just don't find it in video games. And I completely understand why, because it breaks stuff a lot. But I mean, after a year and a half, we're finally ready to go into the heavy side of development. But yeah, I mean, it breaks stuff, but it's worth it. I think there's a great audience for it. So,
So how are you going to find a balance between not being an action-heavy third-person shooty game and also not being conversation-heavy like it's a Japanese dating game?
Really, I think going back to our inspiration again of BioWare, I mean, they do a great job of that with Star Wars, Knights of the Old Republic, Mass Effect. They just do a great job of balancing your dialogue, your combat, and really throwing out the lore there throughout the entire thing. So they're a pretty good example of what we're shooting for and how we, when we went through and storyboarded out the entire game, designed the levels and all that, we really tried to space it out very similar.
So at the part where armed conflict comes into this, is that because there's like a violent subgroup that's, you know, raising hell in this situation? Or, you know, because it sounds like, well, if the people in the dome have their guards, right, that keep them safe from the undesirables that are outside, is there somewhat of an uprising going on? Or what is it that makes this guy say, boy, I need to get out of here, but it is actually a conflict to leave? It's not just, like, get on the bus.
So there's actually two things, elements that go into that. The first is the reason of why does this guy want to get off the planet. Actually, you'll find that in the game, we've actually storyboarded out a subplot where as you play through the game, you're actually going to get what we call flashbacks. And it's going to take you outside of your third-person view. And so you're going to be talking with someone, a random NPC, and as you're talking to them, they're going to trigger a memory. And you'll have the option to click and play a flashback. And basically what's going to happen is you're going to start playing in first person, essentially remembering this scene as you tell it to them. So at the top, you're going to see subtitles, and you're actually going to hear yourself narrating this flashback to that NPC while you play it. And so essentially you're reliving that memory while you're talking to them. And as you're playing this little mini game, you have the chance to either mess up that memory or complete it. And if you mess up, essentially you cut off mid-sentence and you stop talking to that NPC. And the effect of that will actually be that NPC will kind of be pissed at you, saying, what, you don't trust me enough to tell you me your history and stuff like that. So assuming you complete all the flashbacks, you'll actually understand that character's motivation for really wanting to get off the planet. But as an individual, but nevertheless, there's always that main plot of just these two factions butting head to head. And in order to collect all those resources that Brian was talking about earlier, like your ship, your crew, and everything else, in order to collect those resources, you really have to start to figure out which faction you agree with more, and you have to start to ally with them. And the problem with that is, and why these two factions have really hit ahead, is the two new leaders of the factions have kind of decided they hate each other. It's no longer you have these civil leaders. Now there's two essentially extremists at each faction. And that's why things are really starting to come to a head, because the leaders are kind of pushing it that way. And you'll find out more and more about that as you go through the main plot.
Okay, so you were talking about gathering up a crew, right? So you have to select people, like, who do I want on my ship? And then you actually have to acquire the ship?
Yep. So basically, that's all part of the main plot. You're going to be going through, and given one of the two factions, they're going to say, hey, I heard this guy's a great person to go to for whatever you're looking for. And each of these crew members are pretty much predestined for you, regardless of which faction you go through. But you will have to get them different ways, depending on which faction you are and stuff. Again, like I said, it's all about replayability. You can play the same character and you'll get the same exact crew, but the way you get the crew, the way you go about finding the crew members, all of that is going to be different depending on the factions you play, how you do your conversations, all of that.
So it's kind of like, I want Joe to join the crew, but I have to figure out what I have to do to make him trust me.
Exactly.
And join. So each crew member can have their own individual backstory, which is like a mission that you have to play through with them.
Exactly.
To kind of win their trust and get them. Okay.
Yep.
So once you get the ship, how far into the game are we at that point? Is this like, I've had to play the game like 10 hours to get my lightsaber, and now I'm a Jedi?
Since we're not too deep into the development side, we know what we've storyboarded out, and we have a general time frame geared out. But we really don't want to comment too much and promise anything that we can't deliver on until we have the prototype 100% good and we've really started alpha testing, which was, I think we should be really deep into that phase by about a year from now.
Okay, well, I mean, we understand that, you know, you're kind of storyboarding out what you want in the game. You're building your laundry list and figuring out how you're going to achieve it. So you can't really make promises about what content's in and not. But I'm saying from your vision, right? Yep. Do you want the weight of the game to be it's like the goal is not the ship is not the goal. It's like the journey to the ship is what you're experiencing, and then you get the ship, and then there's like the second half of the game, or is it just like a little bit because you get to leave Titan? We left Titan, or is that actually where the game starts?
I'm actually going to key in on one word you said there, the journey. it's really all about the journey in this game, and we don't want to set you down one path. And again, replayability, we don't want you to have to go, hey, I get this player, and then I get this player, and then I get the ship, and then I get this player. It's really an open world where you can go through and do it differently each time. You collect this pilot first, and then you go and get your ship next, and then you get your mechanic after that, and then you play it through again, and then you get your mechanic, pilot, ship.
But once I've got the ship, do I fly around like it's like Starflight, and I'm exploring and doing things, or is it just a means to travel?
Brian's going to hate this one. You actually don't use that ship in the game at all until pretty much the very, very end. however, to get the ship, you will be flying a ship. You're going to actually, it's already storyboarded out. You're going to have to, I don't want to give too much away, but you're going to have to essentially win the ship through a flight mission.
So not
card racing,
not a card game, but
we have to race in the desert in these. No,
you're gonna have to find a kid and his mom for some strange reason.
Exactly.
Bet a lot.
We're gonna be slaves, and we gotta free them, but only one of them. And
good times.
Not really. So,
this is not the game you were looking for.
At least that game isn't.
So what's the experience at the cons been thus far? Have you seen like any super weird people or?
Yeah, Chris, he's the super weird person, but
yeah. Okay, so you got to remember, we're at a comic book convention and we're trying to sell a hard science, like very little fantasy sci-fi game. It's hard to market to that when people are looking for Stan Lee and, like, you know, Patrick Stewart and Will Wheaton and like Billy West and all these voice actors. So to like sell a game that isn't quite in production yet and sell them on a source book, you kind of have to like banter towards them. You kind of capture their attention by saying, hey, cool costume. That's from like Star Wars. You should probably you'll like our game. We've played it this way.
Yeah. So, hey, I got an idea for a hashtag for you.
Okay.
Is Occupy Titan. Because it's the Occupy Titan movement, right? The 99% that.
Well, yeah, definitely like works towards the underground. I mean, if we have like a more expansive marketing, that sounds great.
Yeah,
yeah. Going to cons though, it's like you kind of have to like sell some adult ideas towards like teenagers who get it, and then definitely like older people who, you know, have been into sci-fi since they were young kids, and now they're like, you know, middle-aged men walking around buying like T-shirts signed by Patrick Stewart. So you kind of have to,
or you find the guys that have like the Greg Bear or the Ben Bova novel under their arm,
right?
And it's like, hey, you come here.
Like, hey, you like Ender's Game? So, come here.
Yeah, it's too bad Omni magazine isn't around anymore because
they're not.
That was your audience. Oh, no, they're long dead. In fact, you know, it's funny. Denny Atkin, a mutual friend of Brian and ours, actually used to write for Omni Magazine back in the day.
Oh.
We had a laugh about the UFO articles.
We should go talk to him about this, because actually he loves the space shuttle. He loves NASA. He does NASA tweet-ups.
We'll have to steer him toward this.
Like, on the way down to Florida, we were so tempted to stop and go to the Kennedy Space Center and just kind of, like, throw business cards everywhere. Just, like, leave it in the parking lot.
Might get more trouble than it's worth.
Right. So, we'll be famous for, like, the wrong reasons.
It was kind of a mixed kind you went to, but how was the response? Did you get a decent response from the people who were there?
With that, we had a mixture of people across the board. We had parents there with their kids, where we started talking about the fact behind sci-fi, and the parents were interested in their kids learning about it. We also actually had a gentleman walk up, start talking to us about it, and towards the end he goes, "Well, I'm a PhD. Do you want me to write for you as well?" And Spot just goes, "Hey, you've interested me in the pitch just here in the 3-4 minutes that you talked to me. I'm willing to help you guys out." Along with that, we had probably 10-15 people interested in the game, interested in just helping out wherever they could. And again, we're all part of what Tyler here is calling the volunteer army. So with that, we probably could have handpicked another dozen people to join the team, which may or may not happen. But we are always looking for outreach to the community. And if any of these people, we're willing to help us out here, there, or wherever, it would be fantastic.
And the biggest
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the biggest thing to me is that's fantastic that there's that many people excited about it. So I really want to make sure the fans, that everyone that's excited about it gets a chance to somehow get involved. So that's why the volunteer army is awesome.
That is awesome. Now, you mentioned something about education. Is there a possible educational application for what you're putting together? I mean, it sounds like it'd be a great teaching tool for younger folks who want to learn more about space science. Has any thought been put into that kind of educational application?
Actually, Brian, I'm not sure if we talked about this before or not. When I first started all this, I was actually applying to PhD programs in astrobiology. When I decided to make this game, the very first thing I thought was, I want to make a game that, unlike World of Warcraft, where I feel like I just wasted 2 years of my life, I really want people to feel like they walk away from this and hopefully waste a year of their life, but feel like, at least I learned science. So that is definitely something that I've had in the back of my mind this entire time, is I don't want to by any means make people feel like they're learning, but right, at the same time, I want them to be able to, should they get curious, well, there's no way that's realistic, and then they read into it and they're like, oh wow, it is, and then they get even more excited, they're like, wait, and they research it for themselves. So like I said before, it's all about trying to get people to think critically, and one thing I've been trying to do from day one is make sure the science is very open and readily available to them, so if they do get curious, they have their first stepping stone. And that's why the science behind the sci-fi forums are there, to give them that first stepping stone.
To add to that, have you guys played the Assassin's Creed games, especially like 1 to 2 and like 2.5, like around then?
Yeah. You guys are going to hate me, but no.
Okay. So, you know how like...
Let me tell you about Brian. He hates games.
Say, don't worry, apparently. Brian. It doesn't involve
I hate fun and rainbows and puppies, and I hate Disneyland. I tried the first one. I'll be honest, I just tried the first one. I got really bored.
Yeah.
But I heard the second one's a lot better.
Yeah. First one is a great tech demo of the engine. It's just just a very repetitive game. The first one and the second game, like Assassin's Creed 1 and 2, has the option for like going to historic places and looking up historical facts and just like little tidbits. That like it's not really like meant to be the core mechanic of the game. It's like give you a virtual tour of like Renaissance era Italy, but it just kind of sticks with you. Or like, the predated areas and just like, quick fact about this place, or like little historical knowledge, and it kind of like sticks with you. So that's the kind of structure that Tyler told me about. I'm like, I get that. Like, that's cool. Like, no sci-fi game kind of like explores the factual side. Like, if you play Mass Effect 1 and 2, they kind of glance over like what kind of guns you have, or kind of like what kind of medical things happen in the game. It's like, and this is it. That's just the name of it. And you're like, okay. But I guess in our game, we'll have like the backings in the games explaining it, and then we have our source books explaining it too, to like where that theory evolves into, like in the next, you know, in the modern and the modern settings of it. So like we're going for that kind of sense where it's historic and there's facts, but it's not like in your phase educational Carmen Sandiego like style. You need to know your geography.
Mm. Have you guys ever played Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri?
Oh, I thought you were going to say Civilization, but yes.
Oh, no.
For way too many hours.
Yeah. So a lot of the things...
I've played that. Okay, I've played that. Oh, hey. Yeah. God.
It's for funs in that.
But a lot of the things that are different factional ideas that happen in that, I think are kind of applicable, you know, because just the way that different groups of humans, given like the cultural diversity of... what's, you know, who's on the Mars base, basically who repopulated humanity and what's their culture like, right? Because that's going to be a formation of an entirely different culture at that point, because you're going to have that little melting pot of people that are forced to get along. But is that going to be a thing of like, well, the people on Titan have one way of doing things, and like religiously and things like that? Did they develop almost like people that are on another colony or almost aliens now, given a couple hundred years down the road?
Very much so. You'll definitely see each planet kind of evolving their own version of humans.
Oh.
So, and that's kind of where I was going with Brian, where I didn't want to give away too much.
And if you think people like have grudges against, you know, West Coast, East Coast already here, can you imagine what like planetary hatred towards people are going to be like? You know, that kind of thing. There's endless possibilities to see like the evolution of like, not even like, that's not even a word yet, like planetary hate. Like,
yeah,
it's beyond racism almost.
Will there be a zombie DLC?
Oh, God.
Is a stretch goal.
Oh, wow.
We can.
All this, I'm, all this tribal stuff.
I'm kidding. Don't like, do that. Whatever you do.
All this tribal stuff you guys are talking about reminds me of kind of a Lawrence of Arabia type scenario, where you have all these different tribes who just don't get along, even though they should.
And then a magical British man shows up and he leads them in a charge.
That'd be great, especially if you can get Peter O'Toole, because he's still kicking.
Oh, yeah.
God bless him.
He's alive somewhere.
But that's the burden of the British gentleman, because you may be at any time called upon to lead the savages.
Except, you know, he never wears a helmet, and that doesn't bite back. Doesn't, you know, that doesn't happen into the end where, like, you know, hey, no helmet safety.
So what got you guys into game creation? Like Tyler, you just said what you were, what happened with you, you're the PhD thingamajig. But what about the other guys whose names I'm forgetting? Because I'm
Jason the first about this.
what got you guys into game? Like, what was, like, your influential game that said, I want to make these things? Like, what got you into it?
So, personally, I've been playing for about 22 years now, and it all kind of started when I shattered my leg way, way young, and it kind of leads into, like, a child's play situation where I was in the hospital, I started playing games a lot, and as I went through, you know, the next 10 years or so, I was playing games, and I was realizing the effect they had on me, and it really made me want to have that effect on somebody else. To make a game where, you know, I don't care if it hits one person or a million people and makes them break down in tears or makes them go, oh my God, my life has changed. I just wanted to have that one influential point where I could either open somebody's eyes or change their view on something.
Yeah, it's one thing to say, well, I made something that was like a fun shooting gallery. But another thing that it's like, I might have actually made somebody think and form an opinion about something that they wouldn't have otherwise thought of. And not necessarily the opinion that you want them to get.
So, yeah, piggybacking for Asa, I've been gaming, I guess, the same, almost more the same length as him, but I didn't have the whole, I need to have, like, as, you know, a clarity moment. It just came naturally to me to, like, be interested in games. And I was very analytical as a kid, like, understanding the different genres and, like, having the mindset of, like, oh, like, I want to figure out the science behind that. I mean, the programming, the, like, how to, like, learn how to get, like, a text box up, how to do the hello world and have that, like, start, like, talking back to me in its own accord. Yeah, I guess, like, my gaming experience began with my Game Boy. And, you know, and starting with, like, I guess, just, like, my natural Asian background and getting really interested in games. So most of my games also were all, like, in Japanese, too, which didn't make any sense. Like, when I was 4, just accidentally playing dating sims, not understanding what's going on, and just
whoa.
Like, oh, yeah.
Well, see, there it is.
There it is.
As always, the truth is out. That's always the compared, genesis like, of this
background,
game.
Like, it's wow.
It's going to be a space dating sim.
We can throw it in there. I can have a hidden hot coffee mod, just like coffee mode in there. Just
I know I did already tell Brian we will involve relationships. I mean, this is an RPG inspired by BioWare, so you got to have relationships in there. So
yeah.
Well, maybe it could be actually, if you want to make it truly Japanese, it would be dating the goats that were on the Mars colony. And it's actually like matching goats together, being matchmaker.
No, well, it's the chocobo breeding where you need to make the magical goat after like 9,000 inbreds.
No wonder this is
it. And like people have done that to get the golden chocobo. So,
have you ever seen Hateful Boyfriend? God. It's a pigeon dating simulator.
Yes, you're like a little girl and you date birds, and the birds.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I just know this. I don't tell them this during development teams because, like, this is what I do in my free time.
Oh, I'm sorry to out you like this.
Keeps us informed on everything.
You're just one of my
No, we wouldn't know about it ourselves if we didn't weren't reading Let's Plays of it, you know, which are hilarious. So,
yes, my gaming background is bizarre that I don't use for resumes. I don't put them down.
No, I can't use this either.
I can't use this either. Thank you.
Yeah, we can't be a reference for you now. I'm sorry. No.
So,
I was just gonna say you guys have been at it for a while. I mean, 20 years, the original Game Boy.
Yeah. I mean, that's from like 88, so it's not so.
Yeah,
bad.
No, I had one. Yeah, I was hardcore.
I still remember Atari. Good stuff.
I mean,
which one?
Which Atari?
Oh, 2600.
Yeah.
I had 26 and 52. I was spoiled.
All right.
Let me tell you, kids, I used to have to walk uphill in the snow both ways with 50 cents in my pocket to go play Donkey Kong.
Just to plug in his 8-inch floppy.
Yeah.
I never had the 8-inch. I start, oh, it, I'll stop.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that one.
Well, thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, this is the blooper reel for the
podcast. Is this what people tune in for? Is this the show? Did we start yet?
No, I was thinking while we started, I started trying to do the format, and then we just went, screw it. And so I'm like, you know what? Fuck the format. Whatever. This is a conversation. We're going to have fun.
Yeah. You're live.
No bleep.
Get the reference.
Yeah.
Do it live.
Are we live?
So, so were you guys in any kind of tabletop RPG stuff, or have you just always been computer-y guys?
When I was probably 8 or 9, I dabbled in some D&D. I did a lot of trading card games back in the day, including Magic the Gathering, which was one of my bigger ones. And then I was really into multi-user dungeons, which were just text-based adventures on basically online.
Played a lot of Batmud.
Yeah, so that was my kind of upbringing in the RPG sense of things, kind of the obscurity portion of it.
And I've always gotten into really hardcore shoots and ladders. So
I gotta say, speaking of RPG, your universe reminds me of a little bit of the Fading Suns RPG in a lot of ways, because you have the sun thing, obviously. But it's kind of
I'd just like to say that Brian takes any excuse on every show to mention Emperor of the Fading Suns.
No, this is the Fading Suns role-playing game. I'm not talking about Emperor of the Fading Suns, though. Hey, I could talk about that, too. But no, that's
completely unrelated.
No. No, there are... Damn it. There are similarities, I was thinking. And that's a great... Have you guys played that one? That is a fantastic RPG setting?
I don't believe that it's actually a game because Chris is shaking his head no. He hasn't heard of it.
I don't play a lot of tabletop games. I mean, my experience of like tabletop games come from like Warhammer and like that's just like unrealistic beyond belief. So
The universe in Fading Suns is sort of a Renaissance Europe meets Frank Herbert's Dune because they have their own variety of the quote spice. I forget what the heck they call it, but you know, there's that magic dust that makes the universe go round. And then they have like the church that's really heavy handed and comes in, but they'll do things like land the Inquisition on your planet and start killing people, you know, stuff like that, you know, for having heretical technology.
Do they have their own version of Sting in that version? Does he come out in some space underwear?
No, but they do have Kyle MacLachlan. They do have Kyle MacLachlan, who eventually goes into doing a really bad movie with Elizabeth Hurley, or whatever her name was.
Elizabeth
Berkeley. Berkeley. Yes.
She will like first indulge in some Sable-Bell fantasies and then ruin them forever.
Oh God!
I still can't get the pool scene out of my head. Oh, but anyway,
no. Damn,
is that
it.
Sex? I don't know. It seemed like a seizure, and you were just holding her.
Oh God! Well, I guess we should.
So the other podcast I do.
Am I allowed to say that?
There's another podcast. You see, it's called BadMoviePodcast.com, and that's exactly what we do.
Nice.
We'll pick a movie. It's about twice a month. We try to get them out every week, but you know, but it's it's me and another guy that I used to work with that do that. So if you enjoy a good crappy movie or like the Mystery Science Theater kind of takedown,
way too many of those crappy movies.
Oh yeah, well then definitely just take a peruse of that other site.
All right,
I'm sorry,
it's fun.
I'm sorry, Jim. I haven't started listening yet. I just haven't had the time. I feel
that's cool.
Bad.
Start with the Megaforce episode. and Star Crash. Oh my God. That's what you guys need to do.
Italian Star Wars.
Just scrap this Titan game and make Star Crash, and that'll fund the Titan game.
No, dude, Battle Beyond the Planets. You get John Boy. You get.
God! Yes, Battle Beyond the Stars.
Stars, yeah, Battle Beyond the Stars. Yeah, you get John Boy. You get Maverick. No, not Maverick. No, it's Maverick. Not Maverick.
Or Dancing with the Stars. No, that would be a Kinect game. So
anyway, let's wrap this up, guys.
How far off the rails?
Yeah, we're off the rails. I'm losing my mind because I'm exhausted. But that was fun. Thank you. Thank you so much, gentlemen. And I found your names. Chris and Asia. It's Asia? You pronounce it Asia? Asa. Okay. That's how you say it. Asa, I'm sorry. Do you have a last name? Do you want to share it or not? That's up to
Gillette.
You.
Like the Razor, but I don't get funding from them.
That's a shame.
Yeah, I could fund the entire game if I did.
Oh, you're in good company, Razors and Magicians.
But this is a lot of fun, guys. And it's really good to learn more about your game, even though you still can't tell us much, apparently.
Are there Ewoks?
There were a couple days ago, so you never know. They could make their way in.
Oh God! Please no.
A couple days ago, I mean MegaCon. We saw some Ewoks and yeah.
Oh, seriously? Small furry creatures that beat people with stones and logs, or like Gungans, which is frog people and rabbits. So
yes,
really?
Oh man, since you guys like sci-fi, have you ever watched the Red Letter Media reviews of the Star Wars movies?
Oh, those are wonderful.
It's changed my life.
You mean childhood ruiners? Like,
yeah.
Went up facts like I never watched Star Wars again.
Well, the most telling thing was whenever he said, Star Wars Episode 1 is a movie that takes place in a series of conference rooms. And I was just like, oh my God, it is.
It really
and then
is.
I was it was just completely ruined for me. Nothing could save it.
It's kind of like Star Trek The Next Generation. It's a show that takes place in a series of lots of conference rooms. Because it really does.
Well, the thing that bothered me with the Star Trek show is because it was single serving science fiction. Nothing carried over from one episode to the other. So in one episode, Wesley would invent something that would crank the shields up so high that they could hide the Enterprise inside the sun while the bad guys flew by. In the next show, they get hit by a couple of lasers and the shields are down. It's like, come on.
It's not that stuff can't be sustained, man. That's the power that takes too much juice. You can't sustain it for too long. They used it one time. They used it that one time in the sun and it's done. It's like a one use sun condom thing.
I could just see that, like the Enterprise flies by and it's like episode 42, the sun comes.
You know, that does sound pretty scientifically accurate. We might have to remember that one. So,
I invented.
Well, you know, if the solar condom had just been invented, then that whole crown event would have been contained.
Well, now we know what to invest our money in.
That's right, a time machine and a sun condom.
And latex.
If I start a band... That's the name. I'm trademarking that right now. Sun condom. This is what happens when I get tired. I start saying ridiculous shit.
Yep. Yeah, it makes for a good show.
I'm not editing this out either.
Oh, good. That's great. Fuck the family friendliness. You know, be gone with it.
Hide your daughters, hide your wife.
We should really wrap this up. I want to go have my own pool sex seizure. So,
God.
Yeah, we have to listen to it.
That'd be the other band, Pool Sex Seizure. Or that would be my first. That would be Sun Condom's first album, Pool Sex,
Pool Sex Seizure. That's the title of the podcast, Pool Sex Seizure.
Oh, okay.
Episode 5.
That is what I'm naming it. Yes, we're done. Pool Sex Seizure. I'm going to write the notes down right now. Pool Sex Seizure.
It'll be by far the most popular podcast ever.
I will be getting search term traffic for what?
Exactly. It's like, wow. Oh, all right, guys. Hey, it was great having you on.
Hey, thanks for having us. This is fun.
Whenever you survive the con circuit.
Yeah,
good luck with that.
Come on and make some really weird jokes again and... You know, especially at like 12 o'clock at night and get crazy. Let us know.
Yeah.
We will definitely be following up, I'm sure.
And take pictures of terrible cosplay and send it to us.
Well, okay.
You know what the beautiful part is? People volunteer to get their terrible cosplay
videotaped.
Yeah, videotaped. Yeah. While they dance terribly.
Oh, my God. I went to a con one time. I caught Hoverhand and I couldn't touch a girl.
Oh, my God. Yes.
What is this? What's hover? What?
I couldn't touch any woman for 3 months until the hover hand went away. No, it's whenever people you go ahead and tell
her. You get up next to a hot chick and you're really nerdy and nervous and sweaty, so you don't want to touch her. So you
you don't
put your hand on her shoulder. You just kind of hover it, and it looks really awkward in the picture after the fact. And it just goes to show you can't touch a woman.
No, I've seen that with pictures of Summer Glau. There's like a GIF that just shows all these nerds.
There's actually a blog of just pictures of Summer Glau and hover hands. And it's picture after picture after picture.
That has to be a Tumblr.
Well, as someone who has seen her in person, I might say she is really just that intimidatingly pretty.
Yeah, it wasn't my hand that was hovering.
Yeah. Don't edit that either, Jim. Don't edit that either.
Nope. That's all. This is what people tune in for. This is the show right here.
Oh, God. They're just going to have to wait for the juicy bits at the end. All right, guys. We're going to let you go. But thank you so much. That was so much fun. And we will follow up in a little bit just to catch up and see how the game is coming along and everything.
That worked.
Have a great night, guys. Thank you so much for joining us.
Have a good one, guys.
Take it easy.